It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our growing reliance on social media over the past decade has raised a lot of questions about privacy, civility, safety, and addiction. In the past few years, we've added questions about the integrity of our democracy to this list with the Cambridge Analytica scandal, foreign influence on content. Think about those so-called Russian troll farms, a conservative or a liberal bias, and now the controversy over a lack of fact-checking of political ads on Facebook, and we just learned a rejection of political advertising on Twitter. This hour, we'll explore some of the ethical questions surrounding social media and how those questions are or are not influencing our behavior. Later in the hour, we'll talk about how our children are engaging with social media and what we can do to guide them and keep them safe. And we also want to hear from you this hour. How has your social media usage changed? Have you tried to quit? Did it work? Did it not work? We want to hear your story. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me now is Doug Gentile, professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Hello, Doug.
Good morning, Charity. Do you like my costume?
It's perfect. Yeah. The invisible man. Julian Bumano is also here, assistant professor of the School of Library and Information Sciences at the University of Iowa. And Julia, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Doug, I want to start with you. We've talked about this before, but we know that a lot of us engage with social media on an incredibly regular basis. In fact, some people are concerned that it mounts to the level of addiction. What do we know about our usage of social media and what it's what tends to be happening as far as trends with usage?
Sure. Well, certainly usage has been going up and up and up, and that's no surprise. What do we mean when we ask about addiction, though? Addiction means, or it has to mean, more than just does something a lot. And in fact, it even has to mean more than does something somewhat compulsively. To classify as an addiction means you're doing it in such a way that it really starts harming other areas of your life. So it starts harming your work or your school or your sleep, your family functioning, things like this. And I think for most people, it hasn't reached that level. Nonetheless, we can certainly see the pull. I mean, if you've ever just stood for a bus, can you just wait? Or do you feel like you have to pull out your phone and stare at it to distract yourself from that tiny little moment of discomfort rather than just waiting? Because there's really nothing wrong with waiting.
Although I think sometimes now we feel like if you try to just wait and you look around, you see everybody else on their phone, you feel like an outlier.
Yep.
Are people going to stare at you?
Oh, no.
Just wait.
Their attention doesn't broaden that much.
So with people's usage, we tend to pull it out all the time. When does it cross a line? When do we think that that actually does mean that we're addicted to this kind of media?
Well, I think usually the types of questions asked are, you know, have you noticed that your work has suffered because of it? Now, that might be because for different people, it might look very differently. It might be that you keep checking it during work and that kind of makes your work go slower or you make more mistakes. For some people, it may be they're up so late that they're not sleeping well, and then they're not doing as well at work. Is it, you know, harming their ability to have meaningful conversations with their romantic partners or their children or others? When they start noticing it's really, you know, harming areas of their life, that's when I think it becomes clear it's become out of balance.
We will talk more about children later in this hour, but I know that you have studied a lot of children's interaction with media, with video games, with television. A lot of us worry more, perhaps, about our children and addiction. Should we be worried?
Well, it's not entirely clear that kids are much more vulnerable than adults are. So there's a little bit of research that's tending that way. But still, it's still a smaller percentage. It's under 10%, say, of video game players would be classified as addicted to the games. So it's, you know, it's something every parent should be aware of, but I don't think there's a need for, you know, great alarm.
when we try to give up social media, many of us have had this experience. And again, we want to hear from you if you've given this a go or maybe you've been successful. 866-780-9100. Walk us through what happens, Doug. We say, okay, we're going to quit. We're going to quit. We're not going to look at it. I'm going to take Facebook off my phone. Some of us even have apps installed so that we can't look at social media during certain hours of the day. What's the process like?
Well, I don't think we know, at least not scientifically. I've certainly heard from many families who decided to go screen-free in their households. And so they get rid of the TV and they get rid of the, game systems, and they go completely screen-free. Now, I don't tend to recommend that for most families because then you're giving up the benefits as well as any potential harms. But for the families that have talked to me about this, they all say a pretty similar thing. They say the first 2 weeks is hell as everyone is unhappy about it. And after that, everyone gets a whole lot happier, and they start having much, better interactions as a family. They start finding that they had hobbies that they'd forgotten about, and they start, going back to living what they feel is a richer life than they had before. So I don't know that it's, that complete, cutting out all screens is the approach for most people. But if you want to try it, or even if you're cutting out certain things, I think you should expect it's going to be difficult for the first few weeks. But afterwards, you may find that you've got a lot more time that you didn't even realize had been being sucked away.
Julian, I want to bring you into the conversation, and let's talk about some of the questions that people are asking themselves about social media, because a lot of people are asking themselves questions, whether they're using it or stepping away from it. A lot of us are thinking about social media in a different way. What are some of the concerns that people have?
First of all, research focuses on two types of questions. So first, the type of question is, can we identify certain causal factors that would explain why certain people are more likely to quit social media? And researchers often point to personality traits, like, I would say, more extroverted or overtly narcissistic people with more intimate friendship would be more likely to join and continue using social media, whereas more introvert people are more likely to quit. People may or may not be aware of these factors as explaining their behavior. But what's more interesting, and that's the line I'm really interested in, is what kinds of motivations people invoke when at least trying to quit social media. And studies have pointed to a couple of factors, like concerns with privacy, concerns with data ownership, control, and misuse, banality of content and relationships that these social media sites or social networking sites encourage.
So just the shallowness of our interactions?
Yeah, and a sense in which these technologies actually encourage us to become shallower rather than deeper as persons. Obviously, productivity and time constraints, and also fear of addiction. So it's really interesting to sort of link to Doug's discussion, Doug's point. People actually may decide to quit Facebook and other social media sites because they fear that they will get addicted to these sites. So it's a really interesting factor that people, scholars, have been learning from participants in these studies. And then there's external pressures like professional, institutional, social, right? You get a new job, say as an instructor, you don't want to be befriended by your students, so that's an extra reason for you to quit or to limit your use of Facebook, for instance. Or you are in a romantic relationship and there is a symbolic or performative aspect to it. Like quitting Facebook means you're sending a signal that you're committed to your new partner, and other considerations like that.
Interesting. I've been engaging in conversations about social media, yes, through Facebook. So that's kind of a self-selecting group. And you mentioned how introverted people are sometimes the first people to quit. And I have a post here from Genevieve who says that she finds social media to be a godsend for people like her with major anxiety. And she says it really helps keep her sane and alive to connect through to humanity through this way because she prefers communicating in writing. She says it helps me process my thoughts. It gives me time to think critically. And real life conversations are so fast paced that people have typically moved on by the time I've formulated an opinion or response. And like everyone else, my contacts are scattered far and wide. I grew up in one state, went to college in another, and now live in a third. I have friends all over the globe I'll likely never be able to afford to visit, but who I don't know what I would do without. If I had to engage with them each separately via email or phone, it would take a far larger chunk of time out of my life than social media does, although she also admits to having ethical concerns about how these platforms are run. But that, you know, the social engagement that people experience with their friends, that is very real.
Definitely, and I looked at a couple of studies which have shown that actually their social networking sites actually respond to two basic needs that we have: the need to belong, to be part of a group, to interact, to have meaningful interactions and contacts with other human beings, with friends, family, and also a need to present ourselves. Obviously, they are powerful, hence the risk of addiction, precisely mm-hmm. because they respond in such a powerful way to basic needs that we have. And it's really interesting that I ran a...
I'm gonna have you hold that thought for just a moment. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me today, Julian Vomano. He is assistant professor for the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Iowa. Douglas Gentile is also here, professor of psychology at Iowa State University. And we want to hear from you. We're talking about our changing social media usage this hour. Give us a call, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are talking about how we're using social media, some of the concerns, ethical concerns, behavioral concerns, safety and privacy, all of these different concerns that may be influencing our social media behavior. And we'd love to hear from you, your experiences. Do you use social media? Have you quit social media? Are you considering quitting social media? What holds you there? Give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. With me this hour, Doug Gentile, professor of psychology at Iowa State University, and Julian Vomano, who is assistant professor for the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Iowa. And Julian, just before the break, you started to tell us about a poll that you took with your students about why they use social media. So tell us what you found.
Guess what? Most students actually like to engage with social media and sites because that provides them an opportunity to communicate with friends, to keep in contact, to discover or make new friends, stay in touch with friends and family, especially if they live abroad. And just a few of them mentioned, I'd like these sites like Facebook to access information. So they see the good sides of doing this kind of interaction, and they also see the bad sides, and obviously too time consuming. Yeah, these activities are too time consuming. For instance, mindless scrolling, and obviously they have to make a trade off at some point.
Absolutely. Well, I think we can all relate to mindless scrolling. And Doug, I mean, thinking about what Julian
Speaking
was saying.
Speaking of mindless. I like your segue there.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for helping me really delineate it there. But thinking about this from a psychological perspective, what Julian was saying earlier about how it seems to meet some of our needs. Tell me more about that. Like, what are we getting out of social media? What makes it so powerful for us?
Sure.
Well, there's a theory of intrinsic motivation. So what are we particularly motivated to do just, you know, on our own, that says there's an ABC of human needs. The A is autonomy. We like to feel like we're in control of things. The B is belonging. We like to feel connected to other people. And the C is competence. We like to feel like we're good at what we do. And modern media are fantastic at meeting all of these needs, that when you're the one scrolling, when you're the one posting, when you are in control, right? You feel like you're getting to do what you want to do. Because they do show us our friends and family and information, that, you know, makes us feel connected and fills our relatedness need. And because the bar is pretty low for most of these to learn how to use them, you know, the competence factor is very easily maintained. So that makes them motivating, because they are meeting these needs. It also means that if you wanted to stop using them for whatever reason, then you may need to figure out which need it is that's most being met by them, because you're going to need to find another way to get that filled. Otherwise, just like with other addictions, for example, many addictions for substances begin as, you know, a coping mechanism. It's a dysfunctional coping mechanism, but you know, and then if you take them off, you know, try to, you know, break that habit, but you don't give them a better coping mechanism, they're not going to be able to maintain, you know, being off of the drugs, because they just don't have anything else to fill. And so it's the same type of thing. If you are getting your relatedness needs met through social media, you're going to need to find another way to get them met, whether that's doing something in your community or calling people on the phone more or whatever it is. Otherwise, you're just going to keep feeling that hole that needs to be filled, and it'll suck you back in.
Right. And honestly, from a personal perspective, I fear that I have lost the other ways to contact people that I care about, because Facebook has become such a centralized place for people. So although I have these relationships that I value and I want to continue investing in, I'm not sure I can find people in my people in other ways.
And that you call a strategic advantage in business speak. Facebook knows what it's doing there.
For sure. We're hearing from a lot of people. Wendy says, I'm getting more and more disgusted with what we're learning about Facebook. I would love to leave it, but it's my primary link to friends and family. Sean says staying connected or making new connections still tends to be the main reason I stay on Facebook. And we have a number of people on the line who want to talk about their relationship with social media. Mary is on the line from Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hi. You know, the reason I like Facebook, I'm, as a black person, that's one of the only outlets I have for my voice, for my political views. And I don't understand why the media doesn't get suspicious why Facebook is being investigated and 2020 is around the corner. Because you can raise a mob in 20 minutes by typing in your message. And for all the people that are so, you know, disgusted with what happened with analytical, they should read Devil's Bargain as who own analytical. And so they won't be so disgusted. Go back to your library. Get a copy of Devil's Bargain. Thank you.
All right, Mary, thanks so much for sharing that with us. And, you know, Mary feels a real outlet for her political views, her political voice, although we've talked a lot in recent years about how we create this circle around ourselves through social media, where we're surrounded by people who tend to agree with us. Julian, I don't know if that's something you can respond to, but I mean, a lot of people share their ideas in a powerful way through social media, but maybe they're preaching to the choir?
Well, I think there's a couple of things people can do to actually get out of those echo chambers, and one of that would be to actually befriend people or try to engage in conversations with people who have different opinions, who have different views, for the sake of engaging in a conversation. And studies have shown that Facebook is not the best, necessarily the best platform to actually conduct a reasonable conversation with arguments, because the structure itself of the comments and how you can comment to different comments is such that it doesn't encourage this kind of dialogue, right? Obviously, people have to show a lot of good judgment when deciding to what extent they can engage in especially political conversations, religious conversations. And one of the reasons why people actually claimed or invoked as a motive for quitting Facebook is precisely because the political and religious conversations seem to them too shallow, meaningless.
Right. And there's another aspect to engaging in conversations with people who may have different views. I have an anonymous comment here, someone who sent me a private message because, and now I'm going to quote, she says, over the past year, I've experienced a fairly aggressive, abusive form of bullying from one individual. And because your post is public, I didn't feel comfortable posting my response there. This individual stalks all platforms of social media for any interaction they can find involving me. I've had to change all of my profiles to private with as much restriction as possible. This person has used public post, private messaging, email, phone calls, and texting to attack. I've never met this person and I've only just learned their real name. Recently, they have numerous fake profiles they use. Because of this, I've considered leaving all platforms and I'm now very cautious where and what I post. So there's definitely a vulnerability there as well. And you know, that's an incredibly frightening situation, the kind that could cross over into real life very easily. Let's go back to the phones. Pete is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Hi.
I quit Facebook. It wasn't real easy at first, but as an introvert, I found that I couldn't fit. It's a different kind of discourse than anything else that I've done. So it's not like face-to-face communication. It's not like texting. It's not like letter writing. It's not like emailing. And I couldn't get the hang of it. I started to lose friends. I started getting blocked. I have a great sense of humor, I think, and they don't. And I just decided for the sake of peace that I would just leave it. And the only thing I can think is I've never done karaoke. Maybe that would have improved my skills in this platform. I don't know what the answer is.
All right. So in quitting Facebook, was it hard for you? Are there still things that you miss about having that kind of connection?
Yes, it was hard. But on the third hand, I didn't mind not losing 3 hours out of my day checking up on my friends, which the circle got wider and the posts got longer. And then I was just grinding through, trying to keep up with everybody. And I went to kindergarten before they had show and tell, and I think it's a skill I never learned. People stand up and talk, and they've got an eye on their audience, and it seems like they're personal, but I really think there's a lot of posturing on social media.
For sure, for sure. Pete, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And Doug, let's talk a little bit about that, because there is a lot of posturing through social media. The image that we get when we look at someone else's social media profile is not necessarily a reflection of reality, right?
Yeah. And all humans do a thing, it's just built into our brains evolutionarily, called social comparison, where we're always trying to gauge our own worth, our behaviors, how we should be acting in a certain situation based on what's going on around us. And this is one of the reasons why social media have been so linked with depression and anxiety, especially among teenage girls, is that when you're looking at other people's posts, you don't post just anything that happened. You usually are posting something that you're really excited about or perhaps really upset about, but more often you're showing yourself in a pretty positive light. And so as you're looking at this, you end up often thinking, boy, I wish I could do that, or how come they got this, and it starts to encroach on your own sense of self that other people's lives are better than yours in some way, when in fact their life is just the same as yours, but they're only showing you a little snippet that's highly edited and with a filter on it.
You have any advice for how to combat that? Because, when we look, we are seeing this version of reality. It's hard to remind yourself if you're having a bad day and everybody else's day looks amazing. Yeah. It's hard to remind yourself that this is not reality.
And it's an automatic process in your brain. You can't really combat it very well. So just telling yourself that isn't, for many people, isn't going to be quite enough to really combat the feelings that they have. And in a sense, I think much of this is very intentional. If we look at almost every technological advance, and I mean, you can go back to Gutenberg, all of them come with this ability to communicate. And then they start, you know, certainly in the 70s with like AT&T's commercials, you reach out and touch someone. They're telling you that's the, you know, thing they're going to be able to do for you, is they're going to get you much closer to people. But the way they do it is by inserting themselves between you and the other person. And so, in fact, as we're using it to feel connected, we actually feel less connected because we're not really having the same rich interaction that you would have face-to-face or even here, you know, talking basically by telephone.
Right. Well, and it's very interesting to me, and again, we're going to talk more about young people in a few minutes, but it's interesting to see young people moving to other platforms, which tend to be, I think, less text-based, just more photo-based, where the exchange of information is even less than what we're seeing on some of the older social media platforms.
And it's kind of an addiction circle, right? They tell you, you know, you can meet your need for feeling connected by doing this, and then you do it, but in fact it's not quite satisfying enough, so you feel the need even more, so you do it more, so you feel the need more, so you do it more, etc.
Absolutely. Here's a comment from Brandy. She says, I divorced my Facebook account long ago and never have had Instagram, Twitter, etc. I'm attempting to keep my 14-year-old daughter off of it as well. I've driven past the new Facebook facility in Altoona, and it makes me a bit sick to my stomach. I wonder about its emissions and water use, all in order to store my daughter's friends, photos, words, etc. Her friends are 14. Why do their parents find the privacy policies okay? We read them and can't fall for the sale of this free app. So again, you know, some of us are really frightened by all of these different things. But Doug, can you give us another perspective? You're on Facebook. What do you think we can use this for in a positive way?
Well, I think there are many positives, and we've certainly heard about many of them, from being able to express your views, particularly when you know, marginalized people who may not have access to mainstream media. It certainly is a way of connecting with other like-minded people, for people who have social anxieties and or, you know, reasons why they can't leave their house. This really does connect them. I'm not trying to say these aren't connecting, but it's only a certain type of connection. So recognizing that we need more than that as humans and finding other ways to get it so that we keep it in balance. I don't think there's one right way to use social media, but I think if we start prioritizing them over other things in our life, that may be a wrong way.
Yulian, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, actually, there is yet another way of looking at this. So we are often looking at the situation from our point of view, individual point of view. What can we do? And we take for granted that these technologies are out there. We don't have no, we have no control over them or over how they are designed. But actually look at last year, a group of people who work for these social network sites, founded the Center for Humane Technology. So they actually, if you go to their website, they list a couple of things they are very concerned with, like digital addiction, mental health issues, breakdown of truth, ideological polarization. So what they want to do is just work with better designs, like designs that respond to human well-being. Their main agenda is to actually contribute to the design of better platforms that are less addictive, that preserve a sense of privacy, and so on. So there is a sense in which designers themselves, but also the civil society as a whole, can put sort of pressure for on the designers.
Which also invites a lot of questions about whether we can leave these platforms we're so deeply embedded in. And we saw Google Plus get launched and fail because people were already on Facebook. My friends were already on Facebook. My photos are on Facebook. That's where I'm going to stay. So a lot of new questions there. We're going to have to take another short break. And Doug, I know we have to say goodbye to you, but thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Douglas Gentile, professor of psychology at Iowa State University. Julian Vomano is going to stay with us, assistant professor for the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Iowa. We're also going to talk about young people and social media in just a moment. Dr. Amy Shriver is going to join us, a pediatrician at Blank Children's Hospital and assistant professor of specialty medicine at Des Moines University. And, of course, we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about social media, our growing reliance on social media, the ethical questions about our reliance on social media, some of the questions or the decisions that people are making now because of those questions. We want to hear from you. And we also want to hear from you in regard to the social media usage of your kids, your concerns, what you've done to try to guide them as they enter this world and to keep them safe, maybe bad experiences, maybe good experiences. You can give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Julian Vomano. He is assistant professor for the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Iowa. And before I introduce our next guest, Julian, I want to talk just briefly about what you were talking about before the break with employees of social media companies trying to make a movement to create more ethical social media platforms. We just saw that letter yesterday from Facebook employees sent to Mark Zuckerberg about political ads. And a political scientist from Ames, Amy Erica Smith, responded to that on her Facebook page. She says, "This is a good set of recommendations. I want Facebook to adopt something like this set of policies. It should refuse political ad revenue altogether if it's scared to fact-check political ads." And then she says, "On a personal front, I've realized that what I felt when I decided to take a break from Facebook a week and a half ago was betrayal. I had an emotional relationship with the platform because of everything I had experienced here. And over the past month, I came to believe the platform has a policy of lying to me and to people who are more vulnerable than I am. I spend a lot of time and energy trying to communicate information about politics that I believe to be true. I'm not inclined to continue to contribute free, trustworthy content to offset deliberate lies for which Facebook is making money. I'm not going to close my account. I'm going to continue to use this platform to protest. I'm going to try to avoid doing things that will enable Facebook to make money from my behavior." So that's a pretty powerful statement. But it's interesting, Julian, this movement within some of these social media companies to create more ethical social media. Do you really feel like that can combat the forces at the top?
I think so. And one of the reasons why people continue to use problematic, I would say, SNS, like social networking sites, is that they don't have an alternative. Right. So I think the smart move of an ethical move of this, for instance, of the Center for Humane Technologies to actually provide an alternative. Right. And one of the reasons cited in conversations with participants in different studies actually is that they don't have an alternative. Again, they would like to leave Facebook or other sites, but they don't see how at this point. So,
well, let's move the conversation to young people. Joining us now, Dr. Amy Shriver, a pediatrician at Blank Children's Hospital and assistant professor of specialty medicine at Des Moines University. Amy, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Charity.
Well, let's talk about kids and social media. A lot of parents are really scared about their children's interactions on social media. First of all, a lot of young people are on social media. What do we know about the percentage and how many kids are actually using this?
Right. Well, I'm glad that you pointed out that parents have a lot of concerns because it's true, Charity, you and I as parents are what we call digital immigrants. We did not grow up with this, so we're not really familiar with what the impacts are on health, and so many parents feel that way. And then our children, of course, are digital natives, having grown up in the digital world, they have been exposed to this since birth. So it's a different divide that we aren't used to, and we have to navigate that as parents. You know, on average, teenagers are using some type of screens and media, including social media, at least 7 hours every day. That's the average amount. And that's not including the work they do at school on screen. So
Wow. It's
very prevalent. Yeah.
And we find, Julian, I know you've looked at this. We find young people being drawn to different social media platforms than their parents. So even if parents know a lot about, say, Facebook, we don't necessarily know about the platforms that our kids are on. So what are young people drawn to right now?
As far as I know, TikTok, something called like TikTok. But it's interesting.
You're giving exactly the same
kind of... I don't even know. Yeah.
So,
but it's interesting, like 10%, and I know that the numbers are from 2015, like 10% of teenagers actually qualify as heavy social media users, which means more than 3 hours a day of social media plus 4 hours on other screens, which means like 7 hours.
Right,
like Amy
right.
said, like it's incredible.
Well, and Amy, do you know what kids tend to be drawn to? We know a lot of young people are on Instagram, although I have a feeling that the parents are ruining that platform as well. where does the big growth seem to be?
It's true. It's amazing. If you ever have an opportunity to watch the trends of the social media apps over time, it changes quite frequently. And you're right, the parent versus child use actually influences what teenagers are on right now. So teenagers, like my daughter, do really prefer TikTok. They want to go on things like Instagram and Snapchat. I think their parents are trying to rein them in a little bit. And then the older teenagers are very much doing Instagram and Snapchat as kind of their main ones. And it's a little bit less common to see them on platforms like Facebook and Twitter's still kind of popular, too. So those are kind of the ones that I've been seeing.
Now, as a doctor and a mother, are you more concerned, and maybe this isn't a fair question, but are you more concerned about the kinds of interactions kids are having through social media and the kind of vulnerabilities those create, or just the incredible amount of time that kids are spending on screens?
Well, I think you make a good point that both of those are things that we should be considering. And as a matter of fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics has a really great tool for parents to consider both things. So online at the healthychildren.org website, we have a family media plan that kind of helps parents navigate looking out for the content, looking out for the frequency, the types of apps, and the quantity. And as a parent, I definitely want to keep track of the time that my kids spend, but I also just really want to know what they're doing, who their friends are, and if they're being smart about it. And as a doctor, I start talking about social media and just general media use really, really early.
Like how early?
Well, in terms of media in general, we don't recommend any sort of media at all below 18 months. Between 18 and 24 months, you know, it's okay if you Skype your grandma, and that's about it. And then between 2 and 5, we say keep it to less than an hour if you can, and really engage with educational co-viewing of shows and apps and games. And then above 5, kind of in that older kid and teenager arena, we start talking about what we call displacement, right? So if you're using screens or social media, is it displacing your life? Is it getting in the way of your sleep? So we want you to get those screens out of bedrooms, all of the screens, right? Is it disrupting your mealtime? So, you know, try to make rules about having screens at mealtime. And that means that parents should also be aware of their own behaviors. And is it disrupting your homework? Is it disrupting your activities outside, playing and sports and other things? And is it disrupting your abilities to communicate with your friends and have face-to-face interpersonal interactions? So for the older kids, we don't really put a time limit on it. We just talk about, you know, displacement.
And you talk about using devices, of course, almost every kid in a school district now is handed a Chromebook or something along those lines. I mean, devices are used in education all the time, but of course those devices also connect you to all of these other things. Is that a concern, this kind of multitasking and distraction that kids are encountering when they're trying to do what they're supposed to be doing?
Absolutely. You know, I think people, there are people out there who are very proud of their multitasking abilities, but science tells us we actually can only really do one thing well at a time. So it's really a fallacy to think that it would improve our multitasking to be on, you know, media and trying to attempt multiple things at a time. It really just detracts from the one thing you were trying to focus on. So yeah, that is a concern. Absolutely. I think that as your previous experts have said, there are a lot of risks to being on social media, and then there are a lot of benefits to it as well, especially for our teenagers out there. And I think that's the message that pediatricians really want to send to parents, is that just be aware of what the risks are, be aware of what the benefits also are, so that you can't just label this as 100% bad. I think that's a temptation for a lot of parents. Are there risks? Yes. Children who are excessive on media and social media have risks of obesity, sleep disturbance, poor school performance, problematic internet use or gaming disorder, which is about 10% of the population. Multitasking, as you said, can lead to poorer learning. The media exposure can lead to more risky behaviors, for example. You may see other people online vaping and juuling and drinking, and so that can influence your behaviors as a teenager. Obviously, cyberbullying happens, sexting, a big concern. Online solicitation or predators is a big concern. And then mental health and depression are a big concern as well. So lots of risks out there, of course, and we try to talk about that at every Well Child visit. We talk about what I call the grandma rule, which is if you're about to send a text or post something on social media, read it before you send it and see if your grandma could see it. And if you don't think your grandma should see it, you shouldn't send it.
All right. She doesn't have to necessarily understand it, but...
Right. But it's about decorum, and it's about, you know, the idea of your digital footprint, because, of course, we're seeing a lot of adults now kind of having that blowback from your digital footprint and what's being posted. And we worry about political problems. Like, if you're going to post political things, you have to be careful because that can blow back on you later when you're older. Sexual things, obviously, can blow back on you. Posting things about, you know, racist comments will blow back on you. And then posting pictures of yourself engaging in other risky behaviors like drugs and alcohol online, all of those things leave a permanent digital footprint that employers can see, your future spouse can see, and, you know, obviously your grandma if she's on social media. So this digital footprint idea is something that parents need to be aware of and be talking to their kids about.
Parents tend to be very worried about cyberbullying. I was just looking at some information about what parents are most worried about, and cyberbullying is really at the top of that list. Do you feel like maybe we are overly concerned about that and not as concerned as we should be about some of the other things?
I think cyberbullying is one of the biggest concerns, especially when you're a teenager just starting out. And one of the reasons I'm concerned about it has to do with adolescent brain development. So when you start through puberty, your brain changes in a really rapid way. In fact, it's the second most rapid time of brain development for humans, with the first being the early childhood age. And your brain develops segmentally and a little bit unevenly. And usually the first areas that start developing are your amygdala, which is your brain's kind of alarm center or responding to stress or danger, and then your ventral tegmental area, which is your brain's pleasure center. So these two things are developing first, and so that's why we see teenagers engaging in risky behaviors and why we see them maybe saying things that they might not say after a little bit of world experience and more brain growth. So So people will say things in teenagehood that they may not say as they grow older, as their frontal cortex starts developing. So that it is a risk, and it can be devastating. And we've seen, you know, evidence of that with teenage suicides from cyberbullying. So it's a big deal. It's deadly. And yes, we should definitely be concerned about it. But it's not hopeless. And I think that there's a lot that parents can do to support children through that.
So we have about 2 minutes left. Can you give me just a couple basic recommendations for parents? Because I do think we feel pretty overwhelmed in this world with all of these devices and all of these options. What are a couple very common sense rules that you feel should be put into place with our teenagers?
Right. Well, first, I just want parents to know that, again, it's not all bad, because these kids can find a lot of connection with their friends online, support networks, information about health that they might not always find or be, they may be afraid to ask about. They can keep being exposed to new ideas, find mentorship online, and find a lot of inspiration for adults that are doing wonderful things out there that they can kind of model after. So there's a lot of good on social media. But as far as advice for parents, definitely you want to know what apps your kids are using, and then set the safety mechanisms, turn locations off, and make sure when they're posting things, they're not wearing clothing that identify what school they're at or where they're located, so that cyber predators can't find them. It's really common to have like your Warriors shirt on or something, and then, you know, if there are cyber predators out there, they can find you. So just be safe online, and be aware about not friending people on apps like TikTok, which used to be Musical.ly. Don't friend people that you don't know, obviously. And don't give out any personal information online, right?
Right. And it also sounds like you need to have a really open line of communication with your kids about what they're using.
Yeah. I mean, if you're giving your kid a phone, you have to set the ground rules, right? Hey, I'm going to be able to check your social media apps and your communications. This is my phone, actually, it turns out, and I own it. And so I'm going to check up on you. And I'm still going to respect your privacy, but I really need to know things that are happening. I'm going to have conversations with you. I want to know things, and I want you to tell me things. And that's kind of the agreement that probably should be discussed when the phone is first given to a teenager.
Right. I had my daughter sign a contract, so I put it all in writing. Dr. Amy Shriver, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Dr. Amy Shriver, pediatrician at Blank Children's Hospital and assistant professor of specialty medicine at Des Moines University. Julian Vomano, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Julian Vomano, assistant professor for the School of Library and Information Science at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about our social media usage and some of the big questions that people are asking themselves about social media these days. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.